One of the points to make there is that I mentioned the number 20. That's a round number, $20 million. But you know, all the operations come out of that. So the Grapevine pretty much runs as a break even. In fact, they lose some money. I think they probably lost money this year. I haven't looked at their numbers. AAWS generally makes some money, but that's not $20 million. They may make a few hundred thousand dollars, which then gets put into this reserve fund. So the $6 or $7 million that's the reserve fund, you don't make that in a year. It may take you 10 years to make that reserve. So it's an accumulation of money that's got to be preserved in case some emergency arose. And the other point here is that the trustees, the General Service Board, is composed of, here's how it breaks up. There are 7 non-alcoholic trustees who are chosen for their professional capabilities. The other 21 trustees are composed as follows. There are regional trustees who come from the Northeast region, the Southwest, the Far West, 2 areas in Canada. And then there are 4 general service trustees. These are all recovered alcoholic trustees who are made up of the representatives from the Grapevine Board and the AAWS Board. And they're elected annually. There's rotation going on all the time. I mean, we talked about the principles by which this whole thing is run. One of the principles is rotation. It happens all the time. The delegates themselves, I mentioned this before, they're elected for 2 years. But every year, half the delegates rotate out. So there's new people coming in, new blood coming in. There are new trustees coming in all the time. There are generally some new staff people coming in. So you have fresh air coming in along with a solid rock base of people who have been there for a while. What I'd like to move into now is concept number 9, which talks about the creation of leaders. Talking about the conference is structured that way. How are these leaders cultivated? And Israel's going to talk about that.
My name is Israel, and I'm an alcoholic. Concept 9 reads, good service leaders, together with sound and appropriate methods of choosing them, are at all levels indispensable for our future functioning and safety. The primary world service leadership once exercised by the founders of AA must necessarily be assumed by the trustees of the General Service Board of Alcoholics Anonymous. Our understanding of this is that, indeed, sobriety is a miracle, that it is very sacred, and that it was transmitted to us by our founders, Dr. Bob and Bill W., but that those founders, of course, had to go on and serve in a different way, and somehow their leadership had to be transmitted. And the wisdom is that that leadership is transmitted through a process of carefully selecting people to serve in their place. And the hallmark of that leadership is the principle of anonymity, the principle of humility. And that's why we don't have anybody who is permanently a trustee, that leadership is rotated, and that those leaders are chosen because of their example, the example being their humble service, that whatever position they hold is a position they hold in trust, and that they understand themselves always to be servants. We related that then to several of the traditions, 2, 3, 8, 9, 11, and 12. I'll not read those. You can check those out for yourself. And we went on then to
and the principles are what? What were the principles?
The principle being the humble service, that God alone is Lord of the conscience, to quote a Presbyterian tradition, which seems to be appropriate here, that this is not something that we own, but that we are led to experience, that God is the ultimate authority, and the rest of us are simply humble servants who are trying to figure out what it is God is doing next. Mm-hmm. We then related that to our own service, and we highlighted specifically that Nancy exercises this in her weekly activity of making lunch here at Wilson House, and others of us serve as secretaries in groups, but that it's always a rotational kind of leadership. It's never a permanent position. And we see that at work then as this concept is exercised in the leadership at the highest level of our fellowship.
Great. Thank you. Thank you. And I think that very much are the guiding principles. You know, what happens is that as you go through the service structure, you know, being a representative of your group, and then on the district level, and then maybe on the delegate level, your experiences in sobriety, in relating to the people with whom you're working, are the things that are going to make you the leader. And some people are going to react to that one way and some another way. And then people get to be delegates, and then from delegates people get to be appointed members of committees and then members of the General Service Board. And all that process is the AA way of doing things. And some of us, I mean, I came out, my experience I told you last night, I mean, I was kidding around about telling the joke and getting on the board. And I mean, I feel that way about it. I didn't have the foggiest idea what I was getting into. And it was just kind of one of those things. People said, hey, you know, I think you'd be good. And I said, okay. And so I just kept saying, okay, okay, okay. And that's my story. But somebody else's story is that there are people who want to do that. I mean, they set out that they want to be a delegate. I always threaten the members of the conference that, you know, guys, I was never elected a delegate. So what I could do is I could come back in another lifetime, if you guys aren't nice to me, and become a regional trustee as opposed to a general service trustee. But I mean, to do, I don't even want to think about that. But, neither do they. That's right. Anyhow, but the point is that, and also the point is that I've been fortunate, I've been blessed by that experience. The experience of service has been an important part of my sobriety. And to be able to hand that on to somebody else is a great privilege. I don't need to kind of grab it anymore, you know. Somebody else can do it. What I'd like to do now is take a look at how these entities all relate. I mean, we've established the delegates, we've established the conference, we've established the leadership of the trustees. What are the principles by which these people relate? And when you look at concepts 3, 4, and 5, the right of decision, the right of participation, and the right of appeal, these are some of the things that facilitate relationships getting established in a good way. Because remember all the character defects that you came in here with and are now freed from. Today. Well, once in a while, those surface in a conference. So if you revert back to a right of decision, to a right of participation, and to a right of appeal, in dealing with those, you can continue the dialogue. You can continue the relationship. It doesn't break down. People don't walk off into a corner and say, I'm not going to play anymore. I don't want to be in this. I don't want to do this. People come back, and they take their shots, and they start again. So let's group number 3, the right of decision.
Two or more, right? Hi. Hello, I'm Eileen. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm charged with explaining this concept 3, which I barely understand, but I'll give it a go. And it reads, a traditional means of creating and maintaining a clearly defined working relation between the groups, the conference, the AA General Service Board, and its several service corporations, staffs, committees, and executives, and thus ensuring their effective leadership. It is here suggested that we endow each of these elements of world service with a traditional right of decision. Okay, now as I understand this, this has to do with effective leadership and proficiency. It's getting things done. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that there are these entities within the structure, and they have, they're autonomous and to themselves, but they still have a relation to the other entities.
The delegates are autonomous, the Grapevine Board is autonomous, the AWS Board's autonomous, and the GSB, General Service Board's autonomous, just as Eileen said.
Okay. And the I think at the heart of this is the issue of the trusted servant. And in the description, the explanation of this, it says the charter provisions cannot by themselves ensure smooth functioning and proper leadership at the several different levels of service which are involved. And it talks about then how the group conscience very often will determine what the GSR reports and so forth, you know, and the GSR very often will be just a messenger of what the group wants to say. However, when you're in a larger format of a meeting, perhaps other issues are brought up and there are other perspectives that are brought into bear. And so what happens at that moment is that person has to make a decision, perhaps not in accordance with what the group conscience had dictated. And this is the right of decision.
Yeah, perfect.
And
so the delegate doesn't have to vote the way his district told him to vote, is the point.
Yeah.
That the district has got to have the confidence in that delegate that they're going to see all the issues that have been surfacing. I mean, when you walk into that conference with 120 people, with all these various people coming from different places, your vision gets opened up tremendously. And so that person has to rely upon their best judgment. And that's where it simply comes down to.
It says, nevertheless, the instructed delegate who cannot act on his own conscience in a final conference vote is not a trusted servant. All he is just a messenger. I think that's important to understand.
Yeah.
It's a real spiritual concept.
Yeah.
Isn't it? This really means that we ought to trust our responsible leaders to decide within the understood framework of their duties how they will interpret and apply their own authority and responsibility to each particular problem or situation as it arises. This sort of leadership discretion should be the essence of the right of decision. And at the end, the last paragraph starts with, our entire AA program rests squarely upon the principle of mutual trust. And I think that's the tradition that this probably bears the heaviest on is the trusted servant. Also with the I don't remember the number. And the other one about each group, each entity being autonomous.
What is that tradition for?
For, thank you. Okay. And I think that it supports the strength of recovering alcoholics because it forces us to trust more and to be more open and accepting and to listen. And I think it minimizes the weaknesses of AA because I think we all have a need to control and have things our own way. Anybody identify with that? You know, so this is kind of like just relying on the third step that, you know, that whatever the right decision or the right action that is the ultimate or the final outcome might not be our particular choice, but perhaps might be the better one.
Great.
And you had an example, Des had an example of how the different boards or the different entities relate to one another in bearing with a particular issue that came up a couple of years ago regarding one of the staff members.
Well, what happened was that that at one point in time, the trustees were concerned about the leadership on the Grapevine, so they appointed committees and they appointed advisors and outside firms to examine the structure of the Grapevine. And as a result of that, the woman who was running the Grapevine got her nose very out of joint and decided to resign. and that caused great trauma. The years I served as a trustee were signalized by two great traumas. One was the Grapevine trauma, the other one was the General Service trauma. They tell me that these days the meetings are really fun to go to. But that was very traumatic for AA to have the general manager, not the general manager, the Grapevine managing editor resign. And what happened in the fellowship, to give an example, was that people get nervous about that. They're saying, what did the trustees do? What did the Grapevine board do? So I remember very specifically, I was, just after this happened, I was the director of the Grapevine at the time, and I had to go to, where's Martin Luther King from? What was this town that he was from? Where is that? Yeah, well, no, it wasn't Birmingham, but it was someplace in Alabama, though. But I had to go down there to give... Is it Alabama? Wherever his church is. Anyway, it's not important. I'll think of it in a minute. And we had a forum down there, and so I was the new Grapevine director, tossed into the hot seat. To make a presentation on the Grapevine, and of course everybody knew the first question out of the box when I finished was, did the trustees act in accordance with the concepts and the traditions in allowing what happened at the Grapevine to happen? And there was a faction there that was really upset. I mean, really upset. You know how we get. So I had to answer the question honestly, because I was a Grapevine director and I had had a lot of trauma myself with what was going on at the trustee level, because I wasn't a trustee, I was a director. So I'm hammering at the trustees, and I wrote a letter to Gordon Patrick using my right of appeal, who was the chairman of the board, and I said, you got one, and in essence what I did was I cited the concepts, and I said, it doesn't seem to me that you as trustees are acting in accordance with these concepts. He never responded to me. And that just got me more and more furious, as you can imagine. So I finally grabbed him at one of the weekends, and I said, Gordon, you know, I wrote you this letter, I carboned all the trustees, and this is 3 months have gone by, I haven't heard a single word about it. So we sat down, we talked for a half hour about it. I felt better, I understood it. Then he had two of the trustees visit me to find out, you know, what was on my mind really, and to understand that I understood that the trustees could fire me if they wanted to fire me, but I didn't really care. I mean, what's the point? I mean, either we're going to work according to these concepts or we're not. And so we had a discussion, and as it turned out, a great deal of soul searching went on in putting pressure on the Grapevine. The managing director resigned. I mean, my counsel to the managing director was, don't resign. You don't have to do anything. Just wait it out. You'll never get fired. They weren't about to fire her. But she decided to resign. And I hope that was better for her, because it turned out better for the Grapevine. The other trauma was the General Service trauma, in which the trustees had to make a decision about the running of the General Service Office. And the man that had been selected by the previous Board of Trustees was a square peg in a round hole. Terrific sobriety, terrific delegate, terrific regional trustee, but the wrong man for the job, for lots and lots of reasons, which there's no need to go into. It took the General Service Board 3.5 years, approximately. And during this time, I was a trustee, so every single meeting that we had, this was an issue on the table. It was a killer, I got to tell you. It was a horrible thing to have to be talking about. And though finally the decision was made to ask that person to resign, or if he wasn't going to resign, that he should be terminated. And now, once that decision is made by the trustees, remember, the trustees own the corporation. So they can do whatever they want to do. Conference has got no say about that. This is operations of the corporation. The trustees are charged with operating the corporation through, and here's the catch, through the directors of that corporation. So what do? The trustees then say to the AAWS board of directors, AAWS board, our recommendation with substantial unanimity is to terminate Mr. ABC. Well, it took us 3.5 years to get to that point. We're handing down to another independent, remember, this board has the right of decision. They can say, forget it, trustees. We're not going to do that. They have that right. And this is what this is talking about. They've had that right. So it took them a little while before they were willing to go along with the decision. On the other one, where the managing editor resigned, it was easy. I mean, I would have, if the trustees had said to us, fire her, I would have fought that to the death. They would have fired me, and that would have been fine. But with her resigning, it was easy. All you had to say was, well, she resigned. No big deal. We accept. Here, it was a proactive action that the board had to take. And it took them a while to discuss it, go through all the pros and cons, because remember, the board is made up not just of trustees. There are non-trustee directors on the board. There's that balance, again, in the structure. There are non-trustee directors on the AAWS board who weren't party to that decision, which happened in caucus only with the General Service Board. The directors who are non-trustees are not invited to the meetings of the General Service Board. So those people are saying, what's that? What the hell are they doing? What's that board doing? Forgetting sometimes that the board has a right of decision. General Service Board has a right of decision. Just as we had to remember that the AAWS board had a right of decision. So, there you go. Okay, number four, the right of participation. Round of applause for Eileen. Good job, Eileen.
My name's Chip Barslow. I'm an alcoholic. Hi. Member of the Holyoke Noontime Group and Early Sobriety in Western Massachusetts, Holyoke. I was going to ask that all the members of group number four raise their hands, but two of them are out praying for the success of this presentation. And Pat's ready to catch me in case I go. We did all participate. It's Leo, Peter, Pat, Ozzy, two goats, and a conference sheep. Myself. We, as far as the meaning of the concept goes, I think probably the best way to do it would be if we all counted off 1 through 12, starting with Andre. I thought this was an excellent format to bring in the participation aspect of one of the conference principles. And it was great in group number four because we started out with two, and then we got two new members. And our sobriety ranges from very new to a little bit less new. And everybody had something to say. And I think that's the spirit. That's the principle of this concept. How it relates to recovery, I've always been better served if I make the principles personal to me. And I've done that with the steps. I've done that with the traditions. Traditions are now steps 13 through 24, and the concepts are quickly becoming steps 25 through 36. The other thing that helps with understanding and using these for recovery is through the practice of the principles. And the concepts, I think, show us a better way not only to serve the fellowship, but to serve our groups and to serve each other within the fellowship, and also to better serve those outside, as does the principle of participation. at the conference level, experts and informed people are brought in to participate. In particular, on the grapevine, there are people with publishing and management expertise who are not AA members, who are not trustees, but who serve and who also vote at the conference level to improve our service of carrying the AA message. Briefly, the right of participation allows me, as a participant, to show respect, to show support, and to actually invite participation at all levels of recovery and service. The responsibility of participation, as we saw it, were that risks would be taken, commitments would be made, and resolutions would be brought about through that equal participation where everyone is equal, everyone has a right, and through rotation, there's always fresh blood. Through really, in effect, forcing other people to come in to participate while asking that other people leave and cease that level, at least, of participation. On another personal level, in my area, we have two members of the area committee who are not actually on the area committee. One is the institution committee, which is the oldest committee in Western Mass, and has always been independent with its own treasury, its own elected slate of officers, its own articles of purpose, its own bylaws. Yet they have a vote and are always welcome at the area committee. The other is the intergroup committee, which, again, is AA members doing AA work with AA money, but outside the conference structure. And they, too, always have a vote and are welcome at our area committee meetings. The newest is all the young people's committees that meet in Massachusetts, throughout Massachusetts, and they all have a voice on our committee, and our own particular young people's conference committee has a vote also, but all the Massachusetts committees have a voice. And the third personal experience with participation involves, in our area, special needs. Not only the hearing impaired and the deaf, but also the blind. We try to address or are trying to at least look at the needs of people new to our community, visitors who are there for business purposes, such as Des described yesterday. Is there a language barrier? Is there a safety and security barrier? You know, anybody can call in a group and get the location of a meeting, but we need to tell those who are unfamiliar, is it safe? You know, is that part of town safe at night for someone like you? We also need to address the hospitalized and the homebound. Do they have full right of participation? Do we make it easy for them to participate at all levels in Alcoholics Anonymous? There's a quote out of the service manual that says, "The conference is far more concerned with policies, plans, and actions which are to take effect in the future. To take away the votes of trustees and service workers on such questions would obviously be unwise. Why should our conference be deprived of the votes of such knowledgeable people as these?" And, of course, that needs to be extended to the knowledge, the considerations, and concerns of all people who might be members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the last point that, or one of the last two points that we made, is we cannot cooperate if we are not allowed to participate, and cooperation seems more spiritually sound and viable than just affiliation. We need to remove obstacles to participation. We need to remember that any member can have an issue addressed at the conference level. And in looking at all the traditions that were touched by this one concept, the only ones that weren't were 6, 7, and 10. Thank you.
Thanks, Chip. excellent summary on how that applies to the local level, too, in terms of participation. So now we've had decision, participation, and now appeal, which is concept number 5. We have Michelle. Let's speak about that. Somebody checked out of room number 22, by the way, at the marble ledge and left some items in the room, in case you're here.
That's you, Jamie. We're here to protect the rights of the minority.
Good.
Throw a little illustration. My name is Michelle, I'm an alcoholic. Concept 5 is, throughout our world services structure, a traditional right of appeal ought to prevail, thus assuring us that minority opinion will be heard and that petitions for the redress of personal grievances will be carefully considered. We discussed this concept some more today, and the major points that we got from this were the right of appeal for the minority to speak out, and not only for the right for them to speak out, but the need for them to speak out in AA structure. The redress of grievances, so that people who have a minority opinion are able to speak out and let the group know what the total balance is, so that everyone knows not only the majority, but the minority opinion. It goes in accordance with Tradition 3 in that it protects the rights of the individuals, because the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. These people are, anyone is able to attend meetings and say what they believe, and especially in the group conscience meetings, and be heard. The whole structure depends on minority rule, because it is important for the group to be informed of a whole range of opinions. Like I said before, that gives a balance so that they know exactly what where everyone is coming from. And especially in selecting delegates, if they don't have a two-thirds majority rule of the state or provincial authority, all the candidates are put in a hat and the results are left to our higher power. This may weaken the democracy because it also focuses on the minority, but in the long run, it strengthens democracy because the minority is allowed to be heard and less resentments are built up over this. Everyone is able to say their piece, and therefore they're all considered. Unity is a priority. Even though the majority rule is obvious, there is no need for a quick decision. Everyone should be heard. Concept 5 warns us against the tyranny of the majority. And we have a quote here from the AA service manual. More than a century ago, a young French nobleman named de Tocqueville came to America to look at the New Republic. Though many of his friends had lost their lives and fortunes in the French Revolution, de Tocqueville was a worshipful admirer of democracy. His writings on government by the people and for the people are classics, never more carefully studied than at the present time. Throughout his political speculation, de Tocqueville insisted that the greatest danger to democracy would always be the tyranny of apathetic, self-seeking, uninformed, or angry majorities. Only a truly dedicated citizenry, quite willing to protect and conserve minority rights and opinions, could, he thought, guarantee the existence of a free and democratic society. All around us in the world today, we are witnessing the tyranny of majorities and the even worse tyranny of very small minorities invested with absolute power. De Tocqueville would have neither, and we AAs can heartily agree with him. So that is basically the research that we found on that, and we would like to add that as the minority, we would like to propose that Ozzy bring back the goats and the sheep. That is our ruling. Thank you.
Thank you very much. This is a very powerful function at a conference. I've seen it many times where the conference votes a particular action to be carried out, and somebody will get up at the microphone and they will ask for a revote. They will express their opinion. about it, and the discussion will go on again for another 3 hours. For example, a number of years ago, there was a discussion about the literature committee said, we will not publish a pamphlet aimed at gays. The conference approved it. A number of people got up and they said, the chairman said, does the minority wish to have its opinion heard? And the minority did. So they got up and they expressed their opinion. And I remember one of the delegates said to me, Des, he says, you just got to help us do this. I mean, he's a gay guy. He said, you got to help us do this. He said, because, he says, I see people all the time falling, he just said this to me privately, you know, wasn't falling away because they can't get to it. So I got up and I spoke in favor of it. And a number of other people picked it up, and because I was opposed to it, and I went along with the Literature Committee's recommendation. I voted against it. So I then got up and spoke in favor of it and asked for a re-vote, and it ultimately passed, and there was a pamphlet developed. Another example where the conference was protected from the tyranny of the majority was the issue of electing people from outside the New York area to be general trustees, general service trustees. It had been the New York metropolitan area was to develop those trustees, and the rest of the country developed the regional trustees and the trustees at large. So the conference was stampeding into voting in favor of that to allow it to be opened up. And a number of people there said, wait a minute, we haven't had time to sufficiently discuss this. And what happened was the conference changed their vote and postponed it for another year to give the delegates and the trustees and everybody ample time to discuss that issue. And the issue was ultimately passed in the same way that it was originally proposed at the preceding conference, but the majority was just slowed down and people had a chance to digest it and think about it and get a feeling for it. Now moving into the relationship between the trustees and the conference, we have concept number 7. And we have Barry going to speak about that.
Thanks, Del. I'm Barry, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm a little blown away here. I'm one of those drunks that came to meetings and thought that the old adage of just don't drink and go to meetings was all I needed, you know. And I took GSR recently because someone said it was available, you know, and that's something you do. And I'm beginning to understand that if all I did was don't drink and go to meetings, there probably wouldn't be any meetings, you know. And that's why we're all sitting here. Concept 7 says that the conference recognizes that the charter and the bylaws of the General Service Board are legal instruments, that the trustees are therefore thereby fully empowered to manage and conduct all the world service affairs of Alcoholics Anonymous. It is further understood that the conference charter itself is not a legal document, that it relies instead upon the force of tradition and the power of the AA purse for its final effectiveness. You know, and the key to this reminds me of when I was in high school, and, you know, we learned about checks and balances, you know, from our founding fathers. And, you know, I can think back how I'd expect that from Thomas Jefferson or George Washington and the others, that they're brilliant and we had a balance of powers. But from a bunch of drunks sitting around, that somewhere down the road they could realize that to grow and to keep this thing rolling and make some sense had to have its own system of checks and balances, which is what I read this concept to be. Basically, it takes and makes a balance of power, you know, that they saw in the 50s or whenever it was that it needed this, that if we sat around as groups, we'd want a purple big book and a yellow cover and languages in the first chapter in one language and the second chapter in a different language. And we wouldn't know which printer to go to and how much to charge. And there were things that we know well, and we know what we want. We know we want the big book. We know we want a program to grow. And sometimes we don't have the intelligence level or perhaps the wherewithal to handle this. So we created the boards, and because they have to deal in the real world, is what I'm reading here, there have to be some legal implications. As you talked about the circle and the triangle, you know, you can battle for the rest of your lives. And, you know, I recall stories of corporations losing their logos because they weren't protected legally. And I think within that framework, we have put on, according to traditions, I believe it's 7 and 8 or 8 and 9, that we do need service boards and we need people who are very well versed in the world around us, which we have to live in and participate in. But at the same time, we've kept a system of checks and balances which allow us to filter from our base group and our individual person, our own conscience, into group conscience, to regional conscience, to have people that we trust enough to make decisions in our good name, to handle it and be the ultimate power, but understand that the board that they work with, the legal entity, also has some knowledge and kind of like, we'll go along with them. We can knock them down, but we're not going to because we believe in them. And that's kind of what I see in the concept seven.
Excellent. Perfect. And vice versa. You know, the trustees have tremendous respect for the conference and the conference committees. And all in the discussions that go on every day at all the trustee meetings, the concern is, what are we getting from the delegates? What is their desire? What are they getting from the groups? Because remember, the point is that the groups are the effective conscience of AA. Not the trustees, not the delegates, but it's the delegates, the groups, the staff, the trustees, the directors, everybody together in that conference that crystallize. But if you don't have input from the groups, you've lost your starting point. Thank you. Okay. Now, how about the trustees? How do they relate to the corporations? Number eight. Stan.
My name is Stan. I'm an alcoholic. I am truly having a spiritual experience of the educational variety this morning. It's quite an experience. Concept 8, the trustees of the General Service Board act in two primary capacities with respect to the larger matters of overall policy and finance. They are the principal planners and administrators. They and their primary committees directly manage these affairs, but with respect to our separately incorporated and constantly active services, the relation of the trustees is mainly that of full stock ownership and of custodial oversight, which they exercise through their ability to elect all directors of these entities. So basically, the trustees are wearing two hats. One is not so specific. One is really in the form of a board of managers. And they're not executives, not really making final decisions. There's a tremendous balance and counterbalance, and as you heard with the various segments of the organization. On the other hand, what they are is, as it says in the manual, they're a holding company. What are they holding? They're holding stock. And what are they holding stock in? Two separate corporations. One is AA World Services, Inc., and the other is Grapevine, Inc. And for Janelle and Mike and myself, to try and interrelate this and bring this all together to make it palatable for us and to explain it, it's like we're right now with the trustees. We're at the very base of that inverted triangle. You know, it looks crazy when you look at it. It shouldn't stay up there. It doesn't belong.
Mm-hmm. That's true. That is absolutely true. It should not work.
Step eight, in tradition and concept. Step eight. The key word of step eight is willing. Okay, willing. For me to get sober, I have to be willing to get involved. Bill W., who specifically wrote these, he was willing to go any lengths to keep this thing from falling apart, like the Oxford Group, like the Washingtonians. What keeps this pyramid up? It's the concrete that's formed by these concepts and traditions that this pyramid is buried into. And I'm just realizing this morning. I had no idea of how intricate and how complex the balance is, and it's absolutely amazing. For example, the eighth tradition, it's wonderful how he explains it here. The eighth tradition is the utilization of non-professional people forever shall be our servants. But we get people like this, okay? We get people with the right talents, the right abilities to get in there and put their backsides into this and make it all hang together. And that's why it works, and that's why it's not going to topple over. It will stay this way. Thank you.
Beautiful. Thank you, sir. Great job. Now, the working relationships of the conference are described in concept number 10. And we have a new member of our group here.
I'm Betsy, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Betsy.
I'm a complicated alcoholic with a simple concept. And concept 10 is every service responsibility should be matched by an equal service authority. The scope of such authority to be always well-defined, whether by tradition, by resolution, by specific job description, or by appropriate charters and bylaws. Complicated words in here, but I think it comes down to basically responsibility and authority, and that they should match. I've been with my little group for only a few minutes, really. We didn't get too much time to talk about it. But I can see how this relates to me personally, as my job as a GSR for my group. My responsibilities are to show up to district meetings and carry the group conscience of my group into the district and area level. And my responsibility is to bring back to the group what's going on that level. And I can see here where responsibility and authority are carried through on all levels, from the personal, spiritual level to how the whole pyramid works. In that tradition too, the our ultimate authority is the group conscience, but our ultimate authority comes from our higher power, and that's part of my responsibility is in my service position, is to maintain contact with that authority, and not to have my authority of my will and my mind, you know, and my ego, that isn't the authority here.
The other part of it, on authority, each of the corporations, I mean, the AAWS doesn't publish the Grapevine. The Grapevine doesn't publish the Big Book. The delegates don't meet with the General Service Board. The General Service Board doesn't meet with the conference committees. So there is a structure, a very clear structure, with which each entity acts and has independence and freedom to act. Mm-hmm. And they're giving the total freedom to do that.
And there's specific jobs in all of the jobs in the pyramid and all levels, and they are, this says that they are well defined. And in fact they are, and that's how the rotation, I think, works, is mm-hmm. that you can step in, if the job is well defined and the responsibility is laid out. If I'm the secretary, I'm not to do the treasurer's work, I'm not to do the DCM's work, and I have to remember that. I mean, it's a personal issue, because it's easy to want to step over the bounds, you know. I feel like in service work, you know, God utilizes my character defects, you know. And I get to see them, and in essence, they're being used. Maybe I've got an ego, and I want to control things, and that's why I'm in this position. But it also helps me personally, and it's utilized to help the group. So I guess that's pretty much it. Like I said, I think tradition two is the ultimate authority. That's pretty much here, and unity. Tradition one, that this works through the balance of authority and responsibility, and that's the unity of, mm-hmm. of the whole triangle.
Yep. Okay.
I probably left something out, but thanks.
Thank you. And number 11, how the trustees relate to the committees, to the paid workers, and so forth. Glenn.
Hi, I'm Glenn. I'm an alcoholic. And after listening to everybody so eloquently speak, I must say I feel a little inadequate here. And I wasn't here yesterday, but I guess that's why by default I am the presenter for Concept 11. And my two cohorts, Bruce and Van, told me that I'm a real alcoholic, so dazzle them with my footwork. So here goes. Concept 11 reads, while the trustees hold final responsibilities for AA's World Service Administration, they should always have the assistance of the best possible standing committees, corporate service directors, executives, staffs, and consultants. Therefore, the composition of these underlying committees and service boards, the personal qualifications of their members, the manner of their induction into service, the systems of their rotation, the way in which they are related to each other, the special rights and duties of our executives, staffs, and consultants, together with a proper basis for the financial compensation of these workers, will always be matters for serious care and concern. And I guess this intertwines a little bit with Tradition 8, which tells us that Alcoholics Anonymous should always be non-professional, but the service centers may employ special workers. We talked about, trying to, put this in a synopsis of getting good help, helping them to be good help, and then letting them go ahead and do their jobs and have faith about that. It also says that the status of the executives about having one person, and again to have to have faith and trust in that one person will be a competent person and do his job well. Also about the paid workers and how they should be compensated. Obviously, they should be compensated as any other worker who would not be in AA, recovering AA, would come in and do that job, to be paid fairly, because you do get what you pay for. And the musical hats, rotation again. I think the basis is for that is that no one really gains too much power, and that our leaders are but trusted servants and they do not govern, which I think also relates to Tradition 2. I guess that's pretty much it. And just to say again that they should be paid fairly, and to rotate and to share responsibility. That's it.
Thanks, Glenn. One of the floor actions at the 1992 conference was that the general manager of the General Service Office and the Alcoholics Anonymous World Service Board, AAWS, devised an equitable system of pay for the GSO staff that embraces the spiritual principles of Concept 11 and complies with all applicable laws. So that was something that is still being discussed and still being worked on, although there is a very, very effective system for payment in there now. Now, what I'd like to do now is just summarize here quickly for you, and then we'll take a break, and then we'll have about an hour to come back, and I'll share with you some thoughts about my thoughts about AA in the 90s, and then we have a panel, and we'll break up about 1 o'clock. In an article in the... Did somebody... What? No, I understand that. But what we agreed, Peter asked me to just handle the morning session as I would like to handle the morning session. So the way I'd like to handle it is the way I just described. The AA Grapevine, November issue of the Grapevine, has an article in here by Mike Alexander. Now, Mike was the chairman of the AA trustees for 3 years. He was a trustee for 9 years. Then he was brought back as General Service Board chairman of the board. And was that in that position for 5 years. And the title of the article is Butterflies in Beijing, A Butterfly in Beijing. And it's a wonderful article because he quotes a Chinese phrase that says, if a butterfly flaps its wings in Beijing, the change in the air patterns may be felt in New York. And he links that up to AA flapping its wings in the world and changing the air patterns of everything in the world. But one of the things he says, as a young man, he was brought in by Bernard Smith, who was Bill Wilson's lawyer, to handle, and Mike's law firm handled the structure of the General Service Board. And he was brought in as a young associate to work on AA, going back, I don't know how many years, 50 years? Not that many, but 30 years anyway, 30, 40 years. And he goes on to say, he says, Stan's point is so much to the point that how can this whole thing work? He says, Bernard Smith introduced me to Bill W., and it's fair to say that Bill introduced me to AA. What I saw when I looked at Alcoholics Anonymous in those early days was to me a most unusual sight. I saw a conference that had responsibilities but no legal authority. A foundation that had legal authority, and the foundation in those days was the GSB, the General Service Board. A foundation, or General Service Board, that had legal authority, but no one against whom it could be enforced, because the AA groups were autonomous. A fellowship whose members, not the fellowship, decided whether they were eligible for membership. A membership in which members were not required to pay dues or register or abide by what anybody in authority had to say. And finally, I saw a charity organized for noble purposes, but without any money to speak of, and a tradition that would not permit it to accept money from the general public. Nothing I had learned at law school prepared me for my first encounter with AA. Nothing. So, Stan, if you feel you're puzzled, you've had the experience in a small way of service here this morning, and I think you've established clearly the spiritual authority of this, of the concepts of the program, how they relate to the traditions and the steps. In one of the writings, Bill, I think, talks about building a cathedral of the spirit by the service structure of AA. So I think maybe you begin to see in some small way how this is really a cathedral of the spirit, that the anonymity, the trust, the service, the sacrifice, the humility that pertains to each of the individual members and the structures are what is the glue that keeps this impossible cathedral together. It's a powerful management paradigm that shouldn't work in modern day parlance. It's based upon the spiritual characteristics of us as people, giving us total freedom to do whatever we want to do and still work, provided we are anonymous and humble. One of the things that this morning proved to me and last night proved to me, again, as I've always marveled at the conference in action, because I know the conference shouldn't work. In the first 2 days of the conference, we get crucified. Everybody feels rotten. And by the end of it, nobody wants to go home. And what happened to me here today was I've never done this before in terms of letting you guys handle the concepts. And I knew it would work because we're so great. We are great. We are just incredible people. And you know it worked. I learned a lot about the concepts today through you. And I hope you learned about the concepts through me and everybody else. So thank you very much. Take a 10-minute break. So what we do is I just share with you a few summary thoughts about the AA message, first of all, how we have set up a structure to carry out the message to the world, which we just experienced to some extent. The difficulties in doing that, of course, are not only internal to us, our own character defects and our own addictions and whatever, but also there's a very real world out there which is changing consistently. And we as alcoholics respond to that change in our own inimical way. And then share with you some of the history of how the early AAs dealt with change and their fears and how they put them to rest. And how we can use that as a prototype for our own fears, which really results in having us here who have come to study the steps and the traditions and the concepts be outwardly focused. But it doesn't end here, you know, at the weekend. The weekend in itself is a marvelous thing. But the objective is to become involved in the service structure so that that hand of yours which has been touched by the hand of God can touch the hand of an alcoholic out there who hasn't heard of us before and who is still suffering. That's the whole objective of it all, is to be outwardly focused. Because it's by that outward focus, by giving it away, that I've learned to keep it. And I've got it in spades, and you the same way. Stan said to me that, what was that Chinese proverb? If I read something,
I hear and I forget.
I hear and I forget.
I see and I remember.
I see and I remember.
I do and I understand.
I do and I understand. And so you had the experience of doing that this morning. And in terms of the service structure, recovery is enhanced by putting in the third leg of the triangle. The service structure has been developed in response to the alcoholic personality. Somebody gave me a copy of a thing called The 12 Steps Before I Came to AA. Listen to them. Number one, alcohol gave me unlimited power. It helped me manage my life. Number two, I came to believe there was no power greater than myself, and sanity was my middle name. Number three, I turned nothing over to no one. Number four, I made a fearless and moral inventory of everyone I knew. Number five, admitted nothing to nobody. Well, why the hell should I? Number six, had no character defects, just a few little quirks that were part of my charm. Humbly ask God, please, please, don't let the liquor store close before I get there. Number eight, made a list of all persons who had harmed me and decided to get them back. Number nine, got them real good. Often by drinking to get even. 10. Continue to take everyone's inventory, and when they were wrong, promptly let them know about it. Number 11. Had conscious contact with God every morning at 4 a.m. and promised Him I would never drink again. Number 12. Having become spiritually bankrupt, physically debilitated, and emotionally drained as a result of these steps, I walked into my first AA meeting in February 1990. The torture ended, and my life has never been the same since. So that essentially is what this has been all about. You know, the message that we're talking about carrying is the message that this drunk stockbroker analyst brought out to Dr. Bob in Akron, Ohio, more than 50 years ago. All of you have had that incredible experience. And I want you to just trust me enough to do something. If you just put your feet on the floor and close your eyes for a minute and just put your coffee cups down or whatever, and just stay with me now for about 90 seconds to 2 minutes. And if you close your eyes and just take a deep breath, and then just focus on the breath as you're there. Just feel that breath coming and going out of your nostrils. You can hear the noise of people coming into the room. That's fine. You don't have to filter that out. Just be aware of all those things. But just sit there with your hands on your thighs or next to you, your feet on the floor, eyes closed, and just feel the breath coming in out of your nostrils. And then just stay with me as I take you through a little process. Just take a deep breath again, everybody. Breathe deeply. Let it all out. Feel your body relaxing. Speak to your feet and say, toes, relax. To your shins, shins, relax. Thighs, relax. Pelvic area, relax. Stomach, chest. Fingers, relax. Forearm. Just all relax. Breathe deeply. Focus on your breathing. Just feel the breathing coming and going from your nostrils. Hear the sounds. Hear my voice. Hear the silence. I come back to that breathing. Hear the footsteps of people coming into the room. Allow that to be. Drop your shoulders and relax. And your neck, your forehead, your mouth, your scalp. Just be at peace and relax. Focus on the breathing. Just feel the breathing coming and going. Now what I'd like you to do is remember your last drink. Remember how you looked, what you were wearing. What did it feel like? What kind of state were you in? Were you by yourself, with a group? Were you alone? Were you lonely? Were you in pain? Were you hungover? Not your last drink, what was the drink that made you stop? What made you think about stopping? What were those feelings? See it vividly in your mind. Feel it vividly in your heart. When you're ready, just come back into the room and open your eyes and look around you. See where you are. See the people next to you. Hear my voice. Now, the reality of the situation for me anyway is that there was no way to get from where I was to here. So that's the power that we have to share with the world. Now, what happens in the conference or in our groups or whatever, we get mixed up with, you know, ordering the coffee or who didn't order the coffee or whatever, or it's a cross-addicted situation, or it's a situation about medallions, or it's a situation about conference literature, or whatever it happens to be, that kind of gets our woofers and tweeters out of whack. And that's just life. And it's two steps forward and one step backwards. But the fact is, we do have a structure to offer to the world. We do have a structure to take people from where you were a few minutes ago to where you are today. Now, the power of that structure, that triangle of unity, recovery, unity, and service, each of those supported by steps, traditions, and concepts in action, is an unbelievable spiritual force. It is the unbelievable spiritual force that you experienced in getting from that drunk that you were and that last drink into this room. And every time you connect with that, that's what we have to offer. So the real issue is, how do we take that from here and bring it back to the groups? And how do we bring it back from the groups into the area assemblies, into the service structure? Because that's what this is all about. It can't stop here. It's been great to be here, but it has to continue on. A spiritual writer, a Jesuit by the name of Anthony DeMello, wrote this particular parable, story, about this wonderful man who brought the gift of fire to the tribes with which he was associated. He brought fire to them. And they were very delighted to have fire. It changed their whole life, like the fire of recovery changed our life. But then he moved on to another tribe to bring the gift of fire to the next tribe, and the tribe that had gotten the gift forgot to thank him, but because he was such a good guy, he didn't mind. He just moved on. The next tribe he came to, the priests and the chiefs of the tribe were very jealous of him, and they thought, if he gives these people a gift of fire, what will happen is we're going to lose our power. So they killed him. They killed him, and in order to throw the tribe off, pinning them as the guilty parties for killing him, they had his biography written, I should say. They had the implements of fire enshrined in a church, in a big building. They had his picture displayed all over the place. They became the official interpreters of this biography of this wonderful man who they had killed. And anybody who varied from them in their interpretation of steps, concepts, traditions, all those things, were immediately tossed out of the tribe. And the people who came in who venerated the implements of fire, they were pronounced saved, and they were pronounced healed of all their wounds. And the interpretation went on and on and on, and the ritual increased and increased and increased. And the sad thing about all of that is that, involved as they were with all these rituals and with all these traditions and with all these carrying the message of the scribes and the priests and the chiefs and their interpretation and being afraid to be tossed out, the people forgot all about the fire. What our charge here is never to forget about the fire. To keep that fire moving, to keep the promise of recovery open to every alcoholic that wants it in the world. You can't be tossed out. You get all those freedoms, all those rights, all those abilities to make mistakes. Not everything that's said here was said here this few days was right, but who cares? Who cares? We got most of it right. We got together. We got a feeling. We got power. We got a better understanding. In the early days of AA, Bill and the people who, and this is in this particular selection is in the Language of the Heart, if you want to read it. Bill goes on to say that we found that the kinship of having suffered severe alcoholism was often not in itself enough. To cross all barriers, our channels of communication had to be broadened and deepened. Remember now, these are the guys who really were on the doorsteps, the down and outers. Bill made that comment in reference to what he calls the, quote, last gasp cases, who were the early members. The discussion goes on. Now, this is a quote. For years, we old-timers couldn't communicate with folks like these, the high bottoms. Somehow, our transmission lines to them had to be increased in numbers and in power. Otherwise, we'd never get through. Out of much experience, a method was developed. Slowly but surely, the strategy commenced to pay off. With the aid and authority of medical science, and by better presentations, the low bottoms had begun to communicate at depth with the high bottoms. But the tedious process and its sparse results didn't have to go on forever. We joyfully discovered that the moment any AA locality was possessed of even a small group of high-bottom drunks, then progress into this class of topper became progressively faster and easier. Today we know why. One high bottom can talk to another high bottom as nobody else ever could. So this segment of our fellowship grew and grew. And it's probable today, this is back in 1959, and I'm sure it's changed dramatically now, and it's probable that one half of today's AA membership have been spared that last 5, 10, or even 15 years of unmitigated hell. I came in when I was 32. I've been spared a lot of hell that we low bottoms knew only too well. The need to find a way to communicate with the cross addicted, to communicate with the homeless, to communicate with the bipolar, all of whom have an alcohol problem. I'm not saying that we don't have a singular purpose. I know we have to hang on to that. But we've got to reach out to everybody. And it's hard to understand sometimes. And it's hard to get through sometimes. Because they don't understand that they're primarily alcoholics sometimes. You know, I know a guy came in this room, he thought he hated spaghetti. Or he thought he loved spaghetti. That's right, he thought he loved spaghetti. He used to always go to these Italian restaurants when he was drinking. While he was sober for a year and a half, he realized he hated spaghetti. He only went to the Italian restaurants for the Chianti. There are people who come in here, they don't know they're alcoholics. I didn't know I was an alcoholic when I walked in the room. I don't know how many of you did. I used to call myself, I just got a little problem with alcohol. I'm just a problem drinker. People used to laugh, but they said, keep coming back, you'll get it. And I did, and I got it. So some of these duly addicted people or cross-addicted or whatever, I agree with Jamie's point so strongly, you know, that there's no reason to come to an AA meeting and say, you know, I'm a duly addicted something or other. An AA meeting is for alcoholics. Either you are or you're not, if it's a closed meeting. It's sort of a violation to me of that spiritual anonymity that Joanne was talking about yesterday to bring in all these other things, you know? You know, hi, Des, I'm an alcoholic. I'm a duly addicted. And I'm a member of GA. And I'm a member of, and I have an MBA. And I have an MA. And I got this and I got that. So what? Who cares? This is a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, knowing that, we also give people freedom, like we just talked about here, to do whatever they want, so long as they focus on what's important, alcoholism. Because that spiritual principle of anonymity, I truly believe, is the key to carrying the message to the world. That is the key. It permeates all those concepts in so many different ways. Everything is flattened, you know? It's one voice, one vote. Trustee doesn't matter. Director doesn't matter. Delegate doesn't matter. Staff person doesn't matter. The deal is one vote, you're there. I don't care if you're a trustee. It doesn't make any difference. We're all equal. We're all drunks. Listen to this. And this is a quote. We of Alcoholics Anonymous believe that the principle of anonymity has immense spiritual significance. It reminds us that we are to place principles before personalities, that we are actually to practice a genuine humility. To this end, that our great blessings may never spoil us, that we shall forever live in thankful contemplation of him, her, who presides over us all. And that's, of course, as you know, the long form of tradition number 12. Finally, carrying this thought just a step farther, if I can find the page I'm on. Now, in The Best of the Grapevine, it's an article reprinted from 1955. A good friend of AA, Dr. Harry Tebolt, speaks about the meaning of anonymity. And this is what he says, and this is a quote. Its practice results in the preservation of a reduced ego. And second, the continued presence of humility or humbleness. You know, Bill himself tells us that his ego took a hell of a licking in the recovery process. I can support that. My ego took and takes a hell of a licking in the recovery process. But it's of such consummate importance to our fellowship that it was the subject of Bill's last message to us. We are challenged to practice this principle in all our affairs. Tebolt goes on to say, the self as nothing is not easily developed. It runs counter to all our desires for identity, for an apparently meaningful existence, one with hope and promise. To be nothing seems a form of psychological suicide. We cling to our somethingness with all the strength at our command. The thought of being nothing is simply not acceptable. But the fact that the person who does not learn to be nothing cannot feel that he or she is a plain, ordinary, everyday kind of person who merges with the human race, and as such is humble, lost in the crowd, and essentially anonymous. When that can happen, the individual has a lot going for him or her. People with nothing on their minds can relax and go about their business quietly with a minimum of fuss and bother. They can even enjoy life as it comes along. They can participate in a crazy session on the concepts which they don't know a damn thing about. In AA, this is called, and this is the continuation of the quote, the 24-hour program. The final picture I want to leave you with is this. There's a Zen Buddhist concept which describes man's condition. It's a circle symbolizing man as nothingness, encompassed in a square, limitations. Man as nothingness, with limitations. Now, if you add to that square with the circle inside of it, our triangle for unity, service, and recovery. That's the picture I want you to think about for the next few minutes. It says, paradoxically, from that posture, everything is possible for all the reasons we just talked about. It's the principle of the fulcrum at work. The smaller the wedge of the fulcrum in relation to the lever, the greater the lifting power. Archimedes said, give me a place to stand, and I will move the world. The closer we as individuals get to the nothingness of anonymity, the freer and more joyful is life. The closer our fellowship gets to the principle of anonymity, the more unified we are in recovery and service, and the more limitless are the boundaries for carrying the message. If you're nothing, you've got nothing to lose by being sober, and simply by being sober. From this posture, we can surely ride the winds of change and let them fill our sails. And see, the cup is not half empty, the cup is half full. Instead of moaning and groaning about all these things that are coming into AA and these outside influences, we say, what an incredible structure that can stand up and withstand and grow and prosper with all these contrary influences coming into us. No longer will change cause us consternation. It will cause anticipation. Fear will not be called fear anymore. It'll be transferred and called excitement. Importantly, we won't forget the fire of recovery. That's our message.
Close the meeting today with Amazing Grace. Please join in.
Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me.
Channel of thy peace.
Okay. That where there is hatred, I may bring love. That where there is wrong, I may bring the spirit of forgiveness. That where there is discord, I may bring harmony. That where there is error, I may bring truth. That where there is doubt, I may bring faith. That where there is despair, I may bring hope. That where there are shadows, I may bring light. That where there is sadness, I may bring joy. Lord, grant that I may seek rather to comfort than to be comforted, to understand than to be understood, to love than to be loved. For it is by self-forgetting that one finds. It is by forgiving that one is forgiven. It is by dying that one awakens to eternal life. Amen.
And we thank you all for being here and the presenters. And I'd like to say more, but I can't. I got a tough time just being here. Thanks.